What's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to This Moment, the transatlantic bridge connecting Stockholm, Sweden to Harlem, New York City. I'm Chef Marcus Samuelson, one half of This Moment, alongside with Jason Timbuktu Diakite. As you know, our goal is to share BIPOC stories with all of you. And this week is no different. Talking to food writer, food entrepreneur, producer Stephen A. Satterfield, host of the incredible Netflix show High in the Hog, named after the book by legendary food historian Dr. Jessica B. Harris. This series explores Black contribution to global food culture. Definitely a must-watch for anyone interested in learning about our history. We're also going to learn about Stephen's journey to get there, his path, how he carved it out, and how he created, really, a media empire. So, 3, 2, 1. Here starts This Moment with Stephen A. Satterfield.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Stephen Satterfield, I think you know him the best by now by being the great host for High on the Hogs. But Stephen's been on the field for a long time and started many incredible things and always been passionate about food, Black food, and how we document it. Welcome to This Moment, Stephen.
Thank you, Marcus. My pleasure. Appreciate you having me.
So talk to me a little bit about storytelling and food. When did this come into your life? When did you decide this is important and I want to be part of it and I want to be in the intersection of it?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the food component came early on. I'm from Atlanta, and you know, my childhood was, I think, kind of typical for a lot of Black American kids of a certain generation. You know, I grew up, you know, culturally as a byproduct of the church. And so what that meant in my family, both on my mom and dad's side, was that every Sunday, you know, my whole family would convene at my granny's house. My granny, my mom's mom, and my dad would cook food for the congregation after church. You know, after my granny passed, our household became kind of the new gathering place for family, extended family, and so on. So it's always been, I've always had a relationship with food where first, you know, it wasn't a gendered relationship, which I think is super important. You know, the fact that my dad was the primary cook, I think really in hindsight was impactful. And also I always had that association with food and convening, you know, like never just being about the eating, but it was always an event, you know, when my dad was cooking.
So wait a minute, you cooked. So that must have started for grandma and your dad around Thursday, right? Just planning, what are we getting? And was it the same food every Sunday? I want to know what was on that menu.
Yeah, you know, I mean, these are some of my earliest memories, but I can tell you for sure, like I remember in the summers, The name of the church was called Turner Road, the Church of Christ, in Atlanta, Thomasville. And I just remember like my dad just over like vats of oil, like cooking for hundreds of people, frying fish, frying hush puppies, serving like enormous bowls of spaghetti, and the, like, you know, I mean, the garlic bread with the parsley, the dry parsley, the whole thing, you know. And then in my granny's house, yo, it was just like a movie, like for real, like everyone's most, you know, whatever you imagine the pinnacle of so-called soul food to be.
Yes, yes.
Like that was the table every Sunday. I mean, that was like super formative, you know. And then as I got older, in high school, was really the onset of the Food Network. I was deeply influenced by that. And even outside of that, like I started watching a lot of Jacques Pepin and Julia Child in high school. And then, you know, later on, I started to see it more as an emerging industry, but an emerging kind of cultural curiosity. And I remember watching Emeril. Honestly, I remember watching you, you know what I mean? I remember thinking to myself that food was going in a direction where it used to have like a negative class connotation into something that was more like culturally revered, honestly. And so I went to, by the time I was in high school or in college, 2002, I went for one semester to University of Oregon. And I didn't even make it to the second semester before I was in culinary school, because I just knew that this world of culinary arts that was so emergent was like exactly where I wanted to be. So I went to culinary school. I mean, I actually took a year off in between, and then to work in restaurants. And then in 2004, went to culinary school in Portland.
But then also, I think you did something really interesting, becoming a somm, which is kind of, you have to study, you have to taste, but you also have to understand terroir. And Oregon is such a great place to do all those things. Why did you make that choice, which I think is a fantastic choice?
So I became a sommelier at a very young age in Portland. It was an incredible opportunity. You know, I was buying wine at this restaurant that was like 40 years old at the point, called Genoa. I think there's probably like I'm not even lying. I think there's almost like $500,000 wine cellar. Like it's very, very, very old school restaurant. And so just crazy vintages, deep vintages, iconic winemakers. So my education was so fast and so formative that I really started to push myself in the industry, you know, around my colleagues, you know, testing, being in classes and so on. But I started just having this experience, which I'm sure you and many others, especially back then, can relate to, where we're the only ones in the room, right? And it's one thing in culinary school, but it's another thing completely you are basically dedicating your life to, you know. And you don't see yourself, like you don't see that space for yourself. And it wasn't even about overt things happening. It was just that feeling of isolation, that feeling of like, I don't really see a future for myself in this community. And the one, I mean, y'all have seen the movie Somm. I'm sure people have seen it. The part of that, which I felt was really well captured, is like the kind of academic nature of that, like how intensely academic that pursuit is. And yet your classmates, right, the folks you're studying with, that particular fraternity, and it was very much that, it just wasn't my people. I didn't want it like that, but I didn't want to give up on wine because I loved wine and I still do. It's still my greatest joy in life. And so I ended up, you know, moving back to Atlanta. I think I was like 23 or something like that. And I started just looking for other Black people in the wine business. And I've now, mind you, this is like before social media, you know what I mean? So I was literally looking at magazines, which, you know, comes up later in the story. But I remember reading about Andre Mack, who was really like, I mean, he's the big homie now, but he was really like a hero to me back then. And then there was this woman named Selena Cuff, who I read about in Time magazine, and she had started a company called Heritage Link Brands. This is in like 07, I think. And she was importing, she's a brilliant woman, Harvard MBA, a Black woman, who was importing wines from Black-owned wineries in South Africa, which if you know the history of South Africa and certainly the wine industry, Black-owned anything, it's like, pause, you know what I mean? And so I loved what she was doing and really wanted to work in a broader way of using wine as like a catalyst for economic development in South Africa. And the reason for that is, you know, I know this is like, the reason for that was basically the origins of the South African wine industry being colonized by the Dutch, exploiting African labor, exploiting Black labor, bifurcating, segmenting that labor in such a way where you got some competency in the cellar, you got some competency in the vineyard, but never really, and very intentionally, using this segmentation as a way to maintain power. And I remember I had this moment, like as a sommelier, where I was like opening this bottle of South African wine for this, you know, older white couple. And I was really thinking about how absent this story of apartheid was in all of my kind of sommelier education. And yet we talk about the land, the whole thing is about terroir, and there was no real analysis around the theft on the land or the exploitation. And so I wanted to go work with Black folks in Africa who were working in a number of different capacities, and I think post-apartheid wine reclamation projects, viticultural reclamation projects. It was a beautiful time. Our nonprofit was called the International Society of Africans in Wine. It's a mouthful, but we called it ISAW, which is why all of my social handles to this day are ISAW Steven. It's not just a clever thing. It is related to that. And so, yeah, I mean, that lasted for about 3 years. But with the ISAW project, you know, we were making kind of short films about these winemakers, about the history of the South African wine industry. And that is really what I took from me, that period of learning how to distill really complex ideas, complex struggles, land-based struggles, into beautiful and compelling storytelling.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I want to talk to you about Hiring the Hog. Tell me, how did it come about? What, you know, the enormous amount of back and forth, being in the muddle and coming back. How did you decide what stories? Because there's so many stories to share and tell. Give us, you know, break it down. Explain for us.
Yes. I mean, it remains the most surreal experience of my life. I'm not sure what could be more surreal. I was approached by Fabian Tobeck and Karis Jagger, who are the executive producers of the show. Fabian and Karis had got the rights to the book from Dr. J, who I'm sure was thinking like, yeah, good luck, you know, selling this. This book's been out for almost a decade. But Fabi and Karis, they really did it. You know, they teamed up with Roger Ross Williams, who is an extraordinarily talented documentary filmmaker. And basically, they came to me and said, we think you're the person for this. I felt somewhat uneasy. You know, I wanted to talk to Dr. J first to get that blessing. And we had a very long talk, and afterwards I felt, you know, comfortable stepping into this role. And yeah, we filmed it in 2019, in the old world. And I think, you know, in terms of the preparation, as you alluded to earlier, Dr. J, for many of us, was already...
We have to explain, for those who don't know, we just have to give Dr. Jessica B. Harris,
yes,
full name.
Yes.
Extraordinary queen that has documented Black food for 40 years, mm-hmm. you know, at least, you know, mm-hmm. and she's just been serving up these incredible books of knowledge, whether it's been from Africa to America, whether it's been through from Bahia to the Caribbean. You know, her books are just, they're just incredible.
Incredible.
You know, informative.
And, I mean, preeminent scholar, thorough researcher, font of information, culture keeper, like really our matriarch, the matriarch of Black food. Cannot
be. If we're calling her up right now, I would say she's either in Martha's Vineyard or in an apartment in New York, researching something,
yep,
for her next book.
No question.
And she's going to say, Marcus, I only have 4 minutes because I'm in the middle of researching, or call me back next Tuesday, yep, 8:45, because I'm researching. All right, click.
It's really that
it's
deep.
It's polite, it's firm, but don't go outside these boundaries because she's working and she's busy.
She's busy. You know? She's busy. Yes. And I mean, like we have, as you said, 4 decades of scholarship as a result of it, you know, that's really impeccable. And so I was deeply influenced by her work, even going back to my days starting this nonprofit, which is, you know, just a couple years after that is when High on the Hog was first released. And for me, I really, for the first time, started to see the potential for Black storytelling in food on a completely level playing field. because she gave our food that energy, the same energy with that we were reading about with European travel logs and all, you know, history of pasta and the pizza. Did it come from Rome? You know, of course, like France is the center of the culinary universe for centuries, right? We got that same care with High on the Hog, and I was just completely rearranged by the text. And so obviously I think, you know, when I talk about food origins now, a lot of that is because of her, because I felt empowered reading about Black American and really Black diasporic food. Because again, when in media, when your story is missing from the larger cultural conversation, that omission is not incidental, right? There's a reason that that story is not there. And the reason is because your people are not the ones holding power in that society, I can guarantee you, right? And so the power of reading our story through the mind and perspective of Dr. J, it never left me. It really informed me moving from, you know, honestly working and going back and working as a SOM in San Francisco, which I did for a few years, into, no, I have to get back into this storytelling space because I know how important and how empowering and how powerful that can really be if I can be a vessel for that. Yeah, so that's like how I already had this relationship. I just want to set that context because, like, imagine whoever your own personal icon is in your world or your industry, like, that's who Dr. J was for me. And so to not only share the screen, but to share in this retelling of this story, this cinematic retelling, and to be like by her side in Africa, in Benin, in a place that she's been going since the 70s, it was just so overwhelming for me, that the only preparation that I really could do for the series was just to practice mindfulness and the presence of mind to just be there with her and to be there for the magnitude of this experience and this work. And so that's just pretty much how I carried it the whole time.
Is it one episode? Because I'm sure it wasn't easy. It's a lot. It's emotional. You're there. You still got to shoot it. You got to do stuff. Was it one episode, just production-wise, that stood out for you that really touched you more than any other? Like, just and why so?
I mean, there's of course moments in everything. I think everyone kind of saw the most emotional moment of the series at the end of the first episode. And you know, the reason that was the moment is because it wasn't. It really felt like it was our moment, right? Like we were actually having a moment, right? We're standing on a mass grave of our ancestors who didn't make it. I mean, it is so sobering. The vibe already is just like, it's sobering. And, you know, I wasn't there by myself or even in a position that I sometimes, and I know you too, find ourselves in where we are expected to lead. We are expected to sort of hold the line, be the orator, be the communicator, be the facilitator. I didn't have to be that. I was just there in this moment with my idol who was holding space for the moment and who held me down in that moment so that I could do my job and do what I was called into this moment to do. because the, you know, the scene before, like we had a take before that where I was like, I'm not sure if I can do this, you know? And yeah, just like being held down by, you know, an icon, by my hero in that moment, in the context, on the continent, is something that I will absolutely never forget. And it's kind of a strange thing that that moment actually, you know, was shared so broadly. But
well, thank you for sharing that and showing vulnerability and realness, because you really represented all of us in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can, I don't know if I can take any kind of credit for that. I actually think that for most Black folks standing in that same spot under the same conditions, I think you probably would have gotten a similar response. Like we had all of, I mean, it was a very Black crew, the showrunner, the director, the producers, like everybody had a moment there, you know, when the cameras weren't rolling. And so, yeah, as I said, I was in the series, you know, just a vessel, honestly, for her work and for our people really taking pride in understanding the breadth of our contributions in this industry.
Talk to me a little bit about the Rice Kingdom, because yeah. Rice is one thing that when you're on the continent, especially in West Africa, that is so clear that it's such a major part of the culture. But never, unless you from the continent or understand it, it doesn't get associated with Africa in the same way. And that's what the Rice Kingdom says, like, no, it's ours. It came here and it talks about it. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. I love that episode. I love that episode. The Rice Kingdom to me is deep because, you know, we really talk about it in a way that you understand that the wealth of the nation is tied to this, right? Like that's how deep this is. And so while I think a lot of people from the States don't know that history, I love that we were able to center that in the story. And, you know, we see a lot of the derivative dishes of purloos and gumbos and so on. But I really appreciated, and especially like the work of BJ Dennis, that cultural context of the Gullah Geechee community as not only the bridge from Africa, but as the stewards of the culture, and how BJ is centering that in his work today. And more specifically, you know, Rice is an intensely difficult grain to farm. It is a cumbersome agricultural product. And part of the value was not only this particular strain of rice, the magical Carolina gold, which swept the whole world. It's also the particular acumen that Black agrarians had to be able to cultivate this grain that, you know, the land owners, the enslavers, the colonists, et cetera, they did not have that acumen.
So similar to the winemaking in South Africa.
Exactly the same thing, right? Exactly the same thing. And that's why I love that as my own personal origin story, because once you start to see that relationship to the land, you start to see the exploitation of Black labor. And when I say labor, I'm not just talking about our physical bodies, because that's what always that's the perception. That's furthering the racism that only understands the value of Black people through our Black bodies. And so that also includes things like sports, also includes like viral TikTok dances, right? that is such a small and racist and myopic look at the contributions of Black folks. Our contributions are also equally intellectual. And so it was our minds that were being mined just as much as our physical body. And that is why our people were stolen and captured from our homes and our homeland and brought to this country. It was because of our knowledge of how to cultivate this grain.
Wow. So Stephen, I know only some of the food entered, you know, got on the show, but what did you and Dr. Jessica Harris and the crew really eat? I mean, what was the side road grub that didn't make it on the show?
I mean, when we were, I think the most memorable meal was definitely at the home of Romuald Hazome, the artist.
Yeah.
He spent at least a week with his sisters, with other women in the village who were working hard to recreate a meal that would have approximated pre-colonial contact in West Africa. And so, to be honest with you, like, it was so vast that I couldn't like tell you exactly each dish was, but what I took away from that, everything from the plantains to the different layers and stages of fermentation and fish and grains, is that our diets were, have been, can be so diverse in color, texture, flavor, technique. And even for me as someone who, and even actually, you know, Jarrell, who we shared this scene with, who herself is from Benin,
yeah,
right? But having these foods for the very first time. And she's also, you know, a professional food blogger with a huge following. And she's just like, wow, this is so revelatory even for me. And nice. So what I just remember is the both pride and humility of the moment of realizing how much more I personally have to learn, and also how aspirational that table and that moment was as a way of moving towards a new future of what can be possible in a so-called decolonized diet, right? And if not necessarily our traditional foods, and obviously, you know, a lot of these things took many days to make and prepare, but at the very least, the critical thinking around what we consume and really how much of our diets have been lost. And I think like what can be recaptured and reimagined is something that has really stuck with me and will manifest in our work very soon.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's really good. I knew it was funky, I knew it was delicious. Fermentation to a different level. I love it. I just think that what's amazing about your journey, it's super inspirational, right? Because there was a very traditional path for you. And even your ambition was, yeah, maybe I manage a hotel one day. But as you entered the space, you said, screw that, I'm going to double down, triple down. And the world opens up, not through these easy things that was given to you, but you actually have to create them yourself. And here you are leading the most important food show on Netflix, which is so important because it's global. And I think you're such an example of just enter our space in food as a Black foodie, as a chef, as a psalm, whatever it is. And you will find, I don't know what this person's going to find, but I know they're going to find something that speaks for them, right? And anytime they're in doubt, they should read a Jessica Harris book or they should listen to one of your podcasts or grab the magazine, because you really show that it is possible. You just got to enter the space and see where this incredible landscape of food as a Black chef, contributor, whatever it is, it's really for us, you know, and you're a prime example for that.
I appreciate you, Marcus. Thank you so much.
Special thanks to Steven for coming on the show. Now, go run, watch High on the Hog on Netflix. Let us know what you think about it. Follow us on This Moment Podcast on Instagram. Email us at thismomentpodcast@gmail.com with suggestions on who we should bring on the show or any comments. Tune in next week. I have some big news to share. Peace.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.